I'm sure you've heard the expression, you ain't heard nothing yet. You ever heard that? I've heard it for all my life. I thought of it recently in relationship to what I want to say tonight, so I started digging around the internet to see where it came from. And it's apparently been used throughout the 20th century. But the oldest occurrence I could find was way back in 1897. So it's been around a while. The reason it occurred to me is that as we've been studying the book of Isaiah, beginning in chapter 13, there is just one chapter after another about judgment. We've looked at most of those chapters, but it actually extends all the way through chapter 35. Now, what we've done so far is look at chapters 13 through 33. Those form, you could easily arrange those in three different sections, which is exactly what I've done. But the message is the same. It's judgment, and yet God's going to bless Israel. It's judgment, yet God's going to bless Israel. All the way from chapter 13 through chapter 33. But you ain't seen nothing yet. If you're reading those chapters and you come to the end of chapter 33, then you dive into 34, and that's when you say, you ain't seen nothing yet. So, I want to share with you what is the climax to this section, these two chapters, 34 and 35. But it's beyond anything we have seen thus far. So what is it? And does it have any relationship to us? What can we glean from this? So will you turn with me to Isaiah chapter 34? Someone has said, these two chapters form a fitting climax to the judgment and salvation motif, which has been spoken of extensively by Isaiah. Another said, chapters 34 and 35 present the contrasting images of a productive land turned into a desert, that's chapter 34, and a desert turned into a garden, that's chapter 35. Those two images are really well chosen. That there is a sense in which chapter 34 is describing what was a productive land, and it just becomes a devastated desert. Whereas when we get to chapter 35, it's the exact opposite. There is a desert that turns into a garden. That's a nice little image to summarize these two chapters. So, chapter 34 is again judgment on the nations, only you ain't heard or seen nothing until you get to verse 1. Come near, you nations, to hear and heed, you people. Let the earth hear and all that is in it, the world and all things that come from it. Now, this is just the beginning of this section on the judgment on nations, plural. This verse is an invitation for all the people of the world to come and hear and heed what Isaiah is about to say. Now, keep in mind, we've seen this message of judgment all the way from chapter 13. But it was on a particular nation. Now, all of a sudden, he's going to include all the nations of the world. That's why I say, up until this point, we've heard individual nations, but you ain't seen nothing yet, because now we're going to gather all the nations together, and God is going to pronounce judgment on them. So what he's about to say has universal significance. It's not just one nation. It's all the nations. So notice very carefully, he says, let the earth hear, the world, the nations. So it's clearly all nations. He goes on to say in verse 2, for the indignation of the Lord is against all nations, and his fury against all their armies, and he has utterly destroyed them. He has given them over to the slaughter. Now notice, the verse begins with that little word, for, so that he is now going to give the reason for the invitation in verse 1. The invitation in verse 1 was, I want everybody, the whole world, to come. Now, let me explain why. I'm anticipating a judgment, a future judgment, of all the nations of the world. Now, that's never happened. Certainly not in Isaiah's time or shortly thereafter. So Bible teachers come to this and say, well, if you're going to take that at face value, then it's probably talking about something that hasn't happened yet, like the tribulation period. And that is very good suggestion. That's very possibly what's happening. He goes on in verse 3 to say, also their slain should be thrown out, their stench shall rise from their corpses, and mountains shall be melted from their blood. So he's simply saying, now he said in verse 2, they were going to be utterly destroyed. See that little phrase? So what he's doing now is he's describing it in more detail, and he's basically saying in verse 3, the bodies that are of the slain are going to be tossed to the ground. They're going to rot on the ground. Their blood is going to sink into the mountains. It's the mountain. The blood is going to run red on the mountains. In other words, this is just going to be a devastating slaughter. By the way, what does the book of Revelation say about blood being up to the horses' bridles? Remember that little phrase? Interesting. At any rate, this is describing the corpses lying on the ground, unburied. Now, that is significant in the ancient world especially, because for an unburied corpse to lie on the ground was a shameful thing. So it's not only slaughter, but they're put to shame. He says in verse 4, all the host of heaven shall be dissolved, and the heaven shall be rolled up like a scroll, and all the host shall fall down as the leaf falls from the vine and as the fruit falls from a fig tree. Now all of a sudden, he's saying that this judgment is not only going to affect people on the earth, it's going to affect the heavens. The Lord will roll up the heavens like a scroll. Now, in the ancient world, they didn't have books, they had scrolls. Well, to roll up the scroll meant I'm done reading it. It's like saying I closed the book. That's the way we would say this. I'm finished reading, it's done. But apparently, this is talking about the sun, the moon, the stars will wither and fall like grapes or figs, that there's going to be some kind of heavenly phenomena. Now, when does this happen? Some suggest that if you look at the book of Revelation, the sixth seal in chapter 6, verses 12 and 13, something similar is described. Others relate this to the eternal state when the sun will no longer be needed. That's Revelation chapter 21. And still others suggest that this may be figurative, that it's talking about the fact that all human kings will be done away with and God alone will be in control in the kingdom. However you handle that verse pertaining to the heavens is one thing, but this much is clear. These opening verses are clearly describing a judgment of all nations. That is clear. Now, that's interesting because in the next verse, he says, verse 5, for my sword shall be bathed in heaven. Indeed, it shall come down on Edom and on the people of my curse for judgment. Now, he just went talking about all the nations of the world. And all of a sudden, for the rest of the chapter, he's going to focus on Edom. That sounds a little odd, especially in light of the fact that he's already mentioned judgment on Edom prior to this in the book. So why all of a sudden does he come back to Edom? Well, Bible students scratch their head and try to come up with an explanation. And one explanation, the one I particularly like, is that Edom was the arch enemy of Israel. The whole book of Obadiah is written against Egypt because of their treatment of Israel. So this perhaps is because they were the perpetual enemy of Israel. They were perhaps an appropriate example of what God will do with all the nations. So because of the context of the book, meaning the way God dealt with Edom as a nation individually before, and yet in this context it's in relationship to all nations, many take Edom as an example, one example of what's going to happen to all nations. I think that's probably what he has in mind. At any rate, he says in verse 6, "The sword of the Lord is filled with blood. It is made overflowing with fatness, and the blood of lambs and goats with the fat of the kidneys of rams. For the Lord has a sacrifice in Bashrah, and a great slaughter in the land of Edom." Now he's still talking about Edom, but he's talking about a great slaughter. And there was a place in Edom where there was this great sacrifice. So he's using that as an illustration. It's an animal sacrifice, but obviously he's talking about the fact that this is going to be a sacrifice of people. There's going to be a massive slaughter of people. And this again lends itself to the idea that Edom is an example of all nations. This is going to be a massive, extensive slaughter. He goes on. And verse 7, the sacrifice is enormous. It's not only lambs and goats and bulls and calves, but it's going to be wild oxen, which are never really mentioned as a sacrifice. So these two verses are just talking about the fact this is going to be an enormous slaughter. And he's using animal sacrifices to depict that. Then he explains in verse 8, this is important, "For it is the day of the Lord's vengeance, the year of recompense for the cause of Zion." Ah, there's going to be this slaughter, this huge slaughter of nations, of Edom of which is an example, because of the way they've treated Israel. Do you see that? That's very fascinating, in light of the way that the world has treated Israel throughout the centuries. So the Lord is going to have vengeance. It's the day of the Lord, but only this time it's the day of the Lord's vengeance. And you'll recall, day of the Lord is one of those eschatological terms about the future. So he's going to have vengeance. Now, vengeance here doesn't mean the way we use the word. That is, that it's getting even with somebody. Rather, it refers to God's action of a just sentence. Remember back in Genesis, he said, "Whoever blesses you, I will bless, and whoever curses you, I will curse." That's what this is. This is pure justice. You've cursed Israel, you've mistreated Israel, and all the nations are involved, and there's coming a day when I'm going to pour out my wrath, my vengeance on those nations. So, verse 9, "Its stream shall be turned into pitch, and its dust into brimstone. Its land shall become a burning pitch." Now, you can't read that without hearing a reminiscence of the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. I mean, just look at it. Brimstone, and the land is going to be burning pitch. the result of God's judgment on Edom will be a land ablaze with sulfur and burning pitch, a tar-like substance that seems unquenchable. So he's simply saying that there's going to be utter destruction. Notice verse 9 carefully. Its land shall become burning pitch. So this is what I said at the beginning. The land may have been productive at some point. Now it's going to become a desert, a wilderness, a burning pitch. He goes on to describe in verse 10, It shall not be quenched by night or day. Its smoke shall ascend forever from generation to generation. It shall lie waste. No one shall pass through it forever and ever. When I get done, there is going to be total destruction. By the way, forever and ever in this verse probably simply means from generation to generation. He says forever and ever. So for a number of generations, an incalculable number of generations, the land is going to be desolate. And that is, Edom is an example of what's going to happen to all the nations, perhaps referring to the tribulation period. So he says in verse 11 that he names a bunch of animals. And again, the point is that they are going to inhabit the land. So wild animals and weeds will occupy the land and not people. God is going to judge the land and the people. Now, in the next couple of verses, that is basically what he does. He talks about the fact that the people and the land are both going to be judged. So he says in verse 12, they shall call its nobles to the kingdom, but none shall be there, and all its princes shall be nothing. So this is now the people. There's not going to be a kingdom, no kings, no princes. People. Got it? Now look at verse 13. And the thorn shall come up in its place, and thistles. So in place of the people are going to be thistles, but this is a judgment on the land. It's going to be in ruins, overgrown with thorns. It'll be a sanctuary for strange creatures, some of which we can't even identify. And again, he extends that in verse 14. The wild beast of the desert shall be meat with jackals. So he goes on and names some more animals. So devoid of human population that these animals will be safe enough to multiply. So all of this is a description of devastation. The land is going to be uninhabitable by humans, but animals are going to take it over. And he's specifically referring to Edom. And by the way, I have been to Edom. It's in modern day Turkey, and it's where Petra is. Petra was the capital, and that's a very famous tourist attraction because of its configuration in the mountains. It's pretty desolate down there. That is a pretty desolate part of the world. At any rate, in verse 15, he goes on, talks about more kinds of animals, snakes and hawks. All these creatures will reproduce, and God has given them to possess Edom from generation to generation. So then he says this, look at verse 16. Search from the book of the Lord and read. Not one of these shall fail. Not one shall lack her mate, for my mouth has commanded it, and his spirit has gathered them. So what Isaiah is saying at this point is, go search what I've written. Go search the book of the Lord. It's what I've written. Go search it. It's going to happen. So my prophecies concerning the decree of the judgments of the Lord, are going to happen. Now, this almost is going back to verse 1. Remember, hear, heed, come all the nations of the world, hear, what's going to happen? So he describes this destruction, and then he says, now go search the book. Very similar to verse 1. So he says in verse 17, he has cast the lot for them. His hand has divided it among with a measuring line. They shall possess it forever from generation from generation. They shall dwell in it. So God sovereignly gave the land of Canaan to Israel. And in the future, he's going to give Edom to all these creatures. It's a similar kind of idea. He's going to give the land. He's going to destroy the people and give the land to wild animals. That's the picture of Isaiah 34. Now, if we're going to sum it up, I would say that it needs to go back to verse 2 where it says, this is his indignation. This is his fury. This is his anger. So because of his anger, the Lord will destroy the nations and devastate. The devastation of Edom is simply one example of what's going to happen to the nations. Now, do you understand why I started out by saying you ain't seen nothing yet? We've looked at judgment after judgment after judgment after judgment from chapter 13 to 33. But that was nothing like he just described in 34. So this is the climax of all the judgment that he has pronounced. Now, I want to pause here before we get to chapter 35. I think before I studied Isaiah, I so had heard about Isaiah 52 or 53. You know, those passages that deal with the Lord, predicting the Lord. We've all heard those. That I don't think it really hit me just how strong Isaiah is on judgment. All right, so there's Isaiah 7:14, the virgin birth, you know. There's the great passage in chapter 11 about the Messiah. And of course, Isaiah, there's more, it's bigger. It's actually, the 53 starts in 52, but that's another issue. We'll get to it. But the point is that what we think about are all those references to the Messiah, like Isaiah 7:14, Isaiah 11, Isaiah 53, right? But if you read the book, 13 through 34 are nothing but judgment, judgment. And the climax is chapter 34. So I've tried to both explain the details and yet give you the thrust of what's going on. You need to remember that when you think of the book of Isaiah, 13 through 34 is judgment. Every once in a while he throws in a blessing, but it's judgment, judgment, throws in a blessing. Someone has said, how does this picture of devastation so thoroughly to human beings, that so is so thorough that human beings don't remain alive, harmonize with what we know from the book of Revelation about the tribulation? This author goes on to say, according to Revelation 6:8 and 9:18, half of the world's population will perish by the end of the sixth trumpet judgment. Now, if you read the book of Revelation, that'll ring true. You look at that with a little bit of shock and amazement. Then this author says, many more devastating judgments will fall on earth dwellers after the sixth trumpet, specifically the seven bowl judgments, the worst one of all in the tribulation. Therefore, what Isaiah pictured may be what the earth looks like at the very end of the tribulation, just before Christ returns to the earth. There will be some people left alive on the earth then, but Isaiah's description was perhaps hyperbole to make the point that God will judge all the earth's inhabitants. End of quote. So I say, you read those 13 to 34 in or 33, and you ain't seen nothing yet till you get to Isaiah 34 and the book of Revelation. Now, you ain't seen nothing yet until we get to 35. Remember that in 13 to 33, have I said that enough? I want to impress it upon your brain that you never forget it. From 13 to 34, it's judgment, judgment, judgment. And every once in a while, there's blessing. Judgment, 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 blessing. Remember? 35 is the blessing. I've entitled this the ultimate in judgment and the ultimate in blessing. So let's look at the blessing. Verse 1, he says, the wilderness and the wasteland shall be glad for them, and the desert shall rejoice and blossom as a rose. What? Now, he just gave us a picture of a productive land that's going to become a desert. Now, he's doing the very opposite, and he takes a desert, a wasteland, and he personifies them, says they're going to be glad and they're going to rejoice. Well, deserts don't rejoice, but it's a figure of speech. What he means is they're going to blossom like a rose. So this dry area will become productive, and it's going to blossom and bloom. But he talks about this in very figurative language. They're going to rejoice. He goes on like that in verse 2, and he says, it shall bloom abundantly and rejoice, and even with joy and singing. The glory of Lebanon shall be given to it, the excellence of Carmel and Sharon. They shall see the glory of the Lord, the excellence of our God. Now, Lebanon, Carmel, Sharon, which were once barren, will once again become fruitful. And they're going to see the glory of the Lord. And that's why I say this is the ultimate in blessing. That all the blessings that have been mentioned, you ain't seen nothing yet. Because of, in this case, they're going to see the glory of the Lord, because the glory of the Lord is going to dwell in the midst of the kingdom in Jerusalem in the millennium. And I think that's what he's referring to. So it says in verse 3, strengthen the weak hands and make firm the feeble knees. Say to those who are fearful hearted, be strong, do not fear. Behold, your God will come with vengeance, with recompense of God. He will come and save you. So at this point, Isaiah is encouraging the remnant, the believing remnant of his day, to live according to God's stipulations, that they should encourage the depressed. that's probably what he means by the feeble hands. And the terrified, those whose knees give way, and the fearful. So he's saying, encourage one another, strengthen those who have weak hands, and make firm those with feeble knees, and say to those who are fearful, be strong. Why? Because God is going to deliver us. So the point of verse 3 and 4, basically, is you should encourage one another. So Isaiah exhorts the people that lived during his time to encourage each other in light of God's promises for the future. May I repeat that? I think this is very important. I think this may be a big part of what he's trying to teach. He is saying to them that you ought to encourage one another in the present, in light of what God is going to do in the future. That's critical. So much of this has to do with the future. even if you applied it all to the captivity and so forth, it's all future. But he's saying, no, this has practical implications for right now. Because of what's going to do in the future, you encourage each other now. That's a very important spiritual point. He goes on to say in verse 5, then the eyes of the blind shall be open, and the ears of the deaf shall be unstopped. Then the lame shall leap like a deer, and the tongue of the dumb sing. So physical healing is going to abound. There's going to be changes that will occur among the people, as he will go on to say, as well as the land. So after the rebellious nations are destroyed in chapter 34, there's going to be a glorious kingdom. The features of that period include increased production of the land, the personal presence of the Lord. There will be mutual encouragement among the saints. Every type of disability will be removed. Great rejoicing and celebration will take place, and there'll be the transformation of the desert. You ain't seen nothing yet until you get to the kingdom. Now, he's mentioned in verse 5, in the first part of verse 6, what's going to happen to people. Eyes are going to be blind. People that can't hear are going to hear. The lame are going to leap. And then he obviously is talking also about the land, because he says in the latter part of verse 6, for water shall burst forth in the wilderness and streams in the desert. What an interesting phrase. In other words, simply put, the land is going to be well watered. Why is that important? Ask the farmers in Central California who have a water problem. The parched ground shall become a pool. There's going to be streams in the desert. Verse 37 says the parched ground shall become a pool, and the thirsty land shall spring of water. So the whole idea is water's going to be gushing out of the land. So the latter part of verse 6 says there's going to be water, and verse 7 says, and there's going to be more water. In other words, there's going to be plenty of water for plenty of prosperity and production of the land. Now, there's more. Look at verse 8. A highway shall be there, and a road, and it should be called the Highway of Holiness. The unclean shall not pass over it, but it shall be for others. Whoever walks the road, although a fool, shall not go astray. Now, all of a sudden, he is saying the redeemed are going to safely travel on a highway of holiness, apparently to go worship in Jerusalem. So these are righteous pilgrims who are going to Jerusalem. One commentator says, it will be a highway marked by holiness because only redeemed people will travel on it. Fools, the moral perverse, will not wander into it because they are unholy. He says, is this a literal road? It may be. But it certainly pictures God's people at that time streaming into Zion through a renovated earth. Now, this is one of those aspects of the kingdom that gives some people some trouble. I think this is describing the ultimate. They're going to worship in Jerusalem, down a highway of holiness. They're going to be righteous people streaming down this, apparently to Jerusalem. That is certainly probably what he's talking about. Now, the reason I say that causes some people trouble is actually because this is really developed in Ezekiel 40 to 48. If you're familiar with that passage of Scripture, it is clearly teaching that there's coming a time when Israel's going to dwell in the land, the temple's going to be rebuilt. And those who take the Bible at face value, including prophecy, some take the Bible at face value until they get to prophecy and then they start squirming. But those who take the Bible at face value are forced to say that Ezekiel 40 to 48 is describing what's going to happen in the kingdom, that the Jews are going to go back to Jerusalem to worship. Now, that not all Christians agree with that. I'm one that does. And I think this passage and others like Isaiah 40 to 48 are describing just that kind of phenomena. This point is you're going to be safe going there. There's not going to be any threat. That seems to be his point. So he says in verse 9, no lion shall be there, nor shall any ravenous beast go up on it. It shall not be found there, but the redeemed shall walk there. Simply put, you're safe. Nothing will threaten or endanger your travel down the holy highway to the holy city. So in the kingdom, God's people will once again be involved in certain aspects of the formal religion of the Old Testament. That seems to be the point that is clearly laid out in Ezekiel 40 to 48. So he says in verse 10, and the ransomed of the Lord shall return and come to Zion. Now, if you've been following me and looking at the verses, you'd say, how did you get the idea that they were going to Jerusalem? Okay, Jerusalem isn't mentioned in verse 8. Jerusalem isn't mentioned in verse 9. How did you get the idea they were going to Jerusalem? And the answer is verse 10. The ransomed of the Lord shall return and come to Zion, another name for Jerusalem, with singing and with everlasting joy on their heads. They shall obtain joy and gladness, and sorrow and sighing shall flee away. So verse 10, the last verse in chapter 35. Someone has suggested is not only the climax to chapter 35, but the whole section dealing with God's sovereignty over nations beginning in chapter 13 all the way to verse 35. Quote, the ransomed of the Lord will have everlasting joy with no sorrow, for they will realize what God has done for them. They will rejoice that he will save them from destruction and brought them to peace and prosperity in the fulfillment of his promise. So I say, you can talk about all the blessings mentioned here and there between chapter 13 and chapter 33. But you ain't seen nothing yet until you get to the great blessing of chapter 35, where the Lord is going to be in Jerusalem and the people are going to go there to worship. So this chapter is simply telling us when the Lord blesses Israel with renewal and healing and reversing all the destruction, there will be rejoicing, great rejoicing and singing. That's the point. Some might want to apply this to the return after the captivity in Babylon. But even if you do that, the language is so strong. If that's what it's saying, then it's a foreshadowing of what's going to happen in the kingdom. But I think the language is sufficient to say that it's going to happen in the kingdom. Now, what I want to do is put these two chapters together. Chapter 34 is about what? Judgment. Chapter 35 is about what? Blessing. Put them together. The Lord will judge all nations. It's hard to say that's just referring to Babylon or after the captivity. And greatly bless one nation. Israel. Now, that's the sum of those two chapters. But I want to make a couple of observations. I'm doing a number of things. One is I'm teaching the book of Isaiah. So I constantly want to put it in the overall context of the book. I've mentioned this, but this is the last time I'm going to get a chance to say it. So I'm going to say it again. Chapters 13 to 35 are a unit. And they can be divided very clearly into four sections. 13 to 23 is a section. Then beginning in 24 and going all the way to 33, but I divided it into two parts. And I found some others that agree with that. They divided it in two parts. So you've got 13 to 33, 23. Then you've got 24 to 27 and 28 to 33. Remember those last two sections were the six woes. Remember that? And I divided them into two woes. I dealt with three woes and then three more woes. Those are sections. And the last section is this one. Now, what is the point of all of this? Just to tell us what's going to happen in the future? No. In the context of the book, in the context of Isaiah's time, what was going on that made him say all of this under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, of course? And the answer is Assyria was threatening the whole region. And Israel was making alliances, the southern kingdom, was trying to make alliances with Egypt to protect them against Assyria. So what is he doing? Well, the answer is, or the issue is, I should say, can God deliver them from Assyria? That's the issue. That's the burning question of the day. Can he do it? And what he is saying is, yeah, God can do it. You just ain't seen nothing compared to what he can do and what he's going to do in the future. Now, he's going to protect Jerusalem from the invasion of Assyria. We're going to get to that in chapters that are coming up. But the point, it seems to me, is that God is answering the question, and it's simply this, that he can and will protect you. And therefore, he can be trusted. So in the overall context of the book of Isaiah, you are not trusting the Lord, you're trusting the alliance with Egypt. Let me tell you the God you're dealing with. He is capable, and you should trust him. Because of what he's going to do in the future, you should trust him in the past. I mean, for the present. So, one author said this. However, the issue remains, is this merely an abstraction, or is it a concrete reality? Ahaz had proved that the nations cannot be trusted. But what of God? Can his trustworthiness be demonstrated or only asserted? Most of his promises for the distinct future or the distant future can be clung to blindly, or is it a reality that we can experience now? Get the drift? He's asked a very good question. The answer to that is in the next chapter. Matter of fact, it's in 36, 37, 38, and 39. Now, just in case you didn't get it, that was a commercial. Because we're going to study those chapters, and those chapters demonstrate this is not an abstract dream of the future. It's a reality because God did protect Jerusalem against Sennacherib. And that's those chapters which we'll get to in the next session. In the meantime, I've answered how this fits into the book. How does this fit into your pocket or your brain or your life? What are we to learn from all of this? Well, I began by suggesting that chapters 34 and 35 were contrasting images of a productive land turned into a desert and a desert turned into a garden. Remember me saying that? I think that's a good image for us to conclude with. You can align yourself with the nations of the earth and choose the desert, or you can trust God and live in a garden. Right? That's really the bottom line, isn't it? Isaiah is arguing that in light of what God is going to do in the future, make a garden out of a desert. You should trust him in the present. Father, thank you for giving us these constant reminders that you will do what you promised. You said that you would bless those who blessed Abraham and his descendants and curse those who cursed them. And Lord, you've said you would do it in your word. You've given us partial fulfillments of that. Thank you for the promise that it'll be totally fulfilled one day. And that because of what you're going to do for them and us in the future, we can trust you for the problems we face tomorrow and our lives. In Jesus' name, amen.